Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. It is Wednesday, June 29th. It's important to timestamp these days. We are recording a little less than 24 hours after the January 6th committee held a surprise hearing with a surprise witness, a name that is, I think, already a household name and will become more so, Cassidy Hutchinson. There's a whole lot we learned during the hearing. Former President Trump really was planning to go up to the Capitol. There was ample knowledge about the January 6th plan within the White House in the days leading up to the riot, and in fact, concern about the potential for violence was contemplated and talked about within the White House. And the White House was aware that people gathered on the Ellipse were armed. But the hearings continue to leave us with more questions. Will the Justice Department pursue Trump supporters or Trump himself for witness tampering? What about allegations of fraud, both in fundraising and in creating a slate of alternate electors? And are the hearings really designed to build a legal case for prosecution? After all, my guests today are two of the reporters who've been following the hearings closer than anyone you can find, both from a political and legal aspect. I'm joined now by Katie Benner, Justice Department reporter at the New York Times, and Peter Nicholas, our national politics reporter here for NBC News. Because like I said, there's legal and political fallout, and they're intertwined. So Katie and Peter, welcome to the Toddcast.
Thanks for having me.
Katie, let's start with the legal, because that, and I think, you know, I was talking to a source over the weekend who was expressing frustration that they didn't think Trump, there had been an investigation on Trump himself yet opened at the Justice Department, that they were still too much on the periphery of things. To me, the almost equally as important bombshell as everything Cassidy Hutchinson said yesterday was Liz Cheney's allegations of witness tampering. So let's just start there. Mm-hmm. What are you hearing out of justice? And I mean, we're up to our fourth potential crime they could begin investigating Trump for, I think, right? When you have the various pressure campaigns on the states, the incitement of a riot, obstruction of a public ceremony, and now obstruction, essentially obstruction of justice and witness tampering. Where are we headed? Where is justice headed?
Sure. So I think that the most important thing for the purpose of any investigation is really understanding what Trump was thinking and doing at the time that these horrible events were going on. And that's been really difficult. So, for example, when we saw the testimony of the Justice Department officials, when we saw the testimony of the state officials, they could only tell you what he said to them. They were unable to get inside of the White House, inside of these more planning conversations. That's what Cassidy Hutchinson brought us. And, you know, whether or not she speaks to the Justice Department, she seems like the perfect kind of witness for them because she was a fly on the wall for every single event. It does not matter what her title was, what her rank was, she was in the room where it was happening. And so she heard really striking things that speak to Trump's intent and state of mind. So, for example, the idea of inciting a riot. A lot of people have said it's going to be really hard to get past the idea of free speech, of mm-hmm. freedom of assembly, and the fact that Trump never said that he invited people to the Capitol only to attack Congress. They were supposed to be there to support his presidency, to support him, etc. But then we have Cassidy Hutchinson saying, you know what, Donald Trump actually knew that some members of the crowd were armed, and he wanted them invited in, and then he wanted them to go down to the Capitol. That really does seem to, in some ways, undercut the idea that he was simply exercising his freedom of speech. And then you keep going, and you see that Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, is telling Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, and Cassidy Hutchinson, and God only knows who else, that if Trump were to go to the Capitol that day, he could be charged with multiple crimes, including obstructing Congress and inciting a mob attack on Congress. And so then you say to yourself, how many people knew that? And was Trump told that specifically? Because what's so startling is that no matter what people have said, he still wants to go to Congress. So Cassidy's testimony really fills in the sorts of blanks that a prosecutor would need to present to a jury to, beyond a reasonable doubt, prove that a crime had been committed.
But Katie, what could be presented? You know, it's interesting. I saw a couple legal experts say that if you take her 2 hours of testimony, that maybe only 30 minutes of it could have made it into a court of law and could have withstood cross-examination. Because take the Secret Service incident. So she's relaying a story that was told to her secondhand, right? So by the time she's delivering it, right, Ornato, we are to understand, the deputy chief of staff, heard it from the Secret Service lead detail who's sitting on the couch in the room. He doesn't tell the story. It's not a firsthand account. It is already a secondhand account. And she is now relaying a secondhand account from her memory, which you could argue now we're getting essentially a third-hand account. No right. prosecutor would put that on the stand, correct?
Of course not. So what a prosecutor would do, and this is the difference between what the hearings are doing, which is making mm-hmm. a really public political argument that, you know, Peter can definitely speak to better than I can. But what a prosecutor would do is they would first interview, the FBI would interview a witness like Cassidy Hutchinson, and then the FBI would reach out right. to the other people in that story and say, do you support this account? What is your version of the account? The FBI and the prosecutors would look at this evidence and say, what can we present to a grand jury, knowing that anything exculpatory would have to be given to the defense at a future right. date, and the defense would be able to present that in court. So to your point, it's not that they would never use something like that. It's more that that kind of evidence would have to be contextualized in a court of law. Is it exculpatory? Does the defense get yeah. to use that? We are seeing a one-sided trial right now. We are right. not seeing any cross-examination, and we are not seeing any questioning of the facts. Now, we should hopefully see some of the folks that she spoke about, Pat Cipollone and these members of the Secret Service. It'd be great if they would testify under oath before the American public.
You know, there's one deposition, full transcript, I'd love to get my hands on right now, and that's the Arenado deposition.
Yeah.
Because it is, I am very curious, number one, did he share with the committee that Trump was irate in the car? He may have a different version. You know, we may be disputing touching the steering wheel and lunging at an right versus he was irate and boy, it, you know, looked like he threatened me. Who knows, right? The details may not matter if he is essentially telling a similar story. But what if he wasn't forthcoming about that individual story and then has to be reminded? Well, that's not the way it went. Yeah. Well, why didn't you tell us the first time? Right. That's something we just don't know the answer to yet.
The Arenado deposition would be quite interesting to see. The committee has talked to him behind closed doors, and maybe they'll try to get him to speak publicly. But I spoke to a source close to the Secret Service who was saying, look, there are aspects of Cassidy's story that's no one is disputing, that Trump did want to go to the Capitol that day. Mm-hmm. He was not happy when Secret Service told him it's not safe and you have to go back to the White House. So I think that the particulars that are going to be rebutted by the Secret Service, it sounds like it's going to be that Trump did not try to grab the wheel. He did not try to physically assault the lead agent. They're going to rebut that, but it seems like there is support for the idea, for the mm-hmm. part of Cassidy's testimony where she said Trump is insistent on going to the Capitol that day.
Peter, let's dig deeper in. I've gotten my share of Trump world spin over the last 36 hours, which has been fascinating, to say the least. But let me, you know, it does seem as if, like I said, the more they're squealing, the more nervous they are. And boy, the squeals are loud on this one.
Well, it's quite interesting. You know, we saw the president responding to this, Chuck, in real time yesterday. He was live tweeting the testimony on Truth Social, his social media site, rebutting her, rebutting specific points. So he is taking this very seriously, and they're obviously deeply concerned about it. This is going to have implications, I think, for his endorsement record. It may have implications for his possible 2024 candidacy. I mean, this is some of the most searing testimony that have come out, as you know, from a very leaky White House over 4 years. I mean, these are some of the most explosive firsthand allegations that we've heard, including, you know, the fact that the president got so upset, he threw his lunch plate against the wall, leaving ketchup dripping down the dining room next to the Oval Office. So there are aspects of this that speak to his character, to speak to his judgment, that will figure into a 2024 presidential candidacy and also the midterms, I would think.
Let's talk about Pat Cipollone. How nervous is Trump world that he's feeling the pressure to testify?
We have to think that as much as Cassidy Hutchinson knows, Pat Cipollone knows more. Pat Cipollone was the White House counsel. He was in sensitive meetings with the president. He was in meetings discussing the implications and liability involved in going to the Capitol that day. He was a senior staffer at the highest level and trusted with secrets. So Pat Cipollone was obviously not happy about what was happening post-election. I mean, that's evident. Was concerned about the planning for January 6th and desperately did not want Trump to go to the Capitol and prevailed upon Cassidy Hutchinson to dissuade him from doing that. So I think his testimony is crucial. We've talked about who is the John Dean in these hearings. Is it
Cassidy? May already have met her.
Is it Mark Meadows? Well, you know, could it also be Pat Cipollone? That was the position John Dean held in the Nixon White House. He was White House counsel. He saw a lot.
You know one, it's interesting. One thing on that is just
the interest
with Pat, he can say because he was the White House counsel, he shouldn't be sharing conversations. He wants to protect some sort of legitimate executive privilege. But keep in mind, executive privilege does not cover discussions of criminal activity. And clearly, Pat Cipollone thought something was happening that could be deemed criminal. Now, Liz Cheney said something very interesting yesterday in her closing remarks. She said, democracy is upheld because people can tell the difference between right and wrong. So it is actually something that Pat Cipollone could do. He could come forward and say, there's a lot I cannot talk about, truly. But the things that I personally, Pat Cipollone, have deemed to be wrong, not covered by executive privilege, I can talk about. This is a judgment call he can make. He does not have to sit blankly by and wait for somebody else to make
Evan
a determination. He is a smart man.
Testified. He's a deputy.
Exactly. So he's a smart guy. He can make this distinction, we hope.
Katie, let's talk about legal. What Meadows asks for a pardon. Asking for a pardon is sort of like pleading the fifth. It doesn't automatically mean you're guilty of something, but boy, you're certainly nervous you could be charged with something and guilty of something. What could be his legal vulnerability here with Meadows? What's his legal vulnerability?
So we don't know for sure, but just based on Hutchinson's testimony and the testimony of the Justice Department officials, if nothing else, perhaps dereliction of duty. Her description of him sitting catatonic, blankly staring at his phone for multiple days, including the day that Congress is being attacked, unable to be snapped out of his reverie except by the idea that his friend Jim Jordan could be in harm's way, was so strange. Even thinking about it now, like thinking about it if you were watching a movie and seeing a character sit unable to move, unable to act, unable to do anything, having already given up and collapsed, saying, we can't do anything. We can't tell him to convince his supporters not to attack the vice president because he doesn't want to. What? Don't you know that attacking the vice president is wrong? And why would you give up so easily on that idea? So I think that perhaps based on the testimony, something like dereliction of duty could be explored, but I can't say, you know, for certain what his legal exposure would be.
You think Mark Meadows ends up testifying, Peter?
I don't, Chuck. I think that he is resistant. He is in wants to be in good standing in Trump world. I think that he sees the MAGA movement as part of his legacy, something he has to protect. I would be very surprised if he testifies. Now, he's in a strange position because he cooperated to some degree. He turned over text messages, which are quite important.
Of which Trump's already angry with him for the minimal cooperation he has given, right?
Yeah, and we also hear that Trump is angry with him over his book. I mean, Mark Meadows wrote a book where he talked about Trump testing positive before the debate with Joe Biden. Trump wasn't all that happy about that. But I do think that Mark Meadows does not want to run afoul of Donald Trump. Trump is potentially, obviously, a very formidable candidate, 2024, the front runner for the GOP nomination. So I think that for political reasons, he may not want to testify, whereas for Pat Cipollone, I think he has some executive privilege concerns. It's more legal than political.
Let me pause there. We'll be right back after a quick break with both the legal and political fallout from Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony. You're listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press. Katie, what happens? How does the Justice Department's position on investigating Trump change if he is a formal candidate for president in the next, you know, month or two?
So I don't think its position on investigating him changes. They will follow the facts where they lead, and they'll investigate him no matter what, as we saw with Hillary Clinton and as we saw with Donald Trump previously, in fact. But what changes is whether or not the department takes investigative steps that could be made public too close to an election. Mm-hmm. Putting aside Jim Comey's completely outrageous behavior before the 2016 election, in general, the Justice Department doesn't talk about investigations of candidates or people who could impact the election in some way, with it close to an election. Generally, that has been like after Labor Day. But, you know, it's a little bit loose, but they do give you some breathing room before.
But if he does it this year, like, what's close to an election as far as the Justice Department? You know, what? And what do you do?
Like I said, it's generally been around Labor Day, you know, anything before Labor Day.
So it'd be Labor, basically Labor Day of 23.
Right. Well, that's the interesting question, because Donald Trump is one of the most popular politicians in the country, certainly the most popular Republican amongst Republicans right now. Mm-hmm. And if you are thinking about indicting the leader of one of the only two parties in America, the de facto leader of that party, mm-hmm. before the midterm elections, even if he's not running, does that mm-hmm. not impact all the Republican races up and down in every state?
So you'd say Garland would probably view, even though Trump's not on the ballot in 22, view him as sort of, because he's the leader of the party, almost the same way if he were an active candidate.
Right. I mean, like, look at the Hunter Biden investigation. I don't think that he was an active candidate. It was his father. You know, right. You could argue that him not paying his taxes has literally nothing to do with Joe Biden's campaign. And yet the Justice Department under Barr chose not to take any obvious investigative steps on that.
Peter, who is the president's current chief legal advisor on all this?
Ooh, that's a good question. You know, he often fancies himself as his own best advisor, Chuck, as you know. I mean, I wonder.
True, but he's got new lawyers, right? It feels like there's always a new set of lawyers in town.
Yeah.
Right, at Mar-a-Lago. Somebody he meets at Mar-a-Lago or at Bedminster, and then like, yeah, let's put them on retainer.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, like, look, during the election, he was listening to John Eastman. I mean, he's always listened to, he has great regard for Rudy Giuliani. Listens to him.
Whoever tells him what he wants to hear. The lawyer, look, I'm doing some Roy Cohn work, right?
Yeah.
When he first met Roy Cohn gives him the advice that says, just ignore him, sue him, fight him, fight like hell, right? Like, you know, that's his legal advice. Anybody who tells him that, that's who he hired.
It's funny, but Roy Cohn is just looms large in his life and his thinking. As you know, like early in Trump's term, he was saying, where's my Roy Cohn? He was unhappy that Jeff Sessions, his first attorney general, Bill Barr, his White House counsel, you know, he was looking for an aggressive pitbull style lawyer like Roy Cohn. And it doesn't seem to me he ever really found one inside the White House.
God, Giuliani was closer to getting AG than people realize. I've always wondered, talk about alternative histories. That's one. Peter, so to build off the question I asked Katie about what justice would, how they would handle an announced candidate, Donald Trump, if it happens now, I think we think Trump thinks this, right? That his best defense is to be an active candidate.
I think that's just common wisdom in the sense that you're more insulated and protected from prosecution if you're an active candidate. So you have to think that there are people in Trump world who are giving him that advice. But I think that Trump wants to announce for every reason, Chuck, and you know this as well, that he is just wants to be in the game. He wants to be the center of attention. He wants perhaps some focus off Ron DeSantis, the popular Florida governor. He wants to maybe clear the field in advance and signal the fundraisers that they should get on board the Trump train. But also you have to figure that January 6th, Justice Department investigations, the civil proceedings in New York State regarding his company. For all these reasons, he would seem to be better protected if he could say, I'm an active candidate. This is obviously just a political witch hunt to keep me off the ballot. You know, to keep me, to take a chunk out of my hide.
Meanwhile, Peter, the president, former president has to notice the number of Republicans standing up for him after this testimony. I can count on one hand, even if I've amputated three fingers.
You know, that's been quite interesting from the beginning. I had some conversations with various Republican officials before the hearings about what they intended to do. How would they, would there be a war room? Would there be an attempt to discredit the committee? What I heard from them is really no. They think the committee is a distraction, a sideshow. The more potent political issues for them are inflation, rising gas prices, Joe Biden's troubles. They want to keep the focus solidly on those issues. They didn't want to talk about January 6th. And
they don't want to talk about abortion very much either.
So Trump world, is in a sense kind of on its own here. Donald Trump is basically the sole figure who's providing real-time, direct rebuttal to what is coming out of the committee, which is quite interesting.
Look, at the end of the day, it is, Katie, it's important to note what's being pushed back on and what isn't. We know Trump world is very effective at finding a specific detail to push back on and creating a cloud of controversy around it. And it feels like both this, the Hirschman note and that, it's like, if that's all you got, it's actually not going to be, then this testimony was pretty powerful.
Yeah. And it's like what we were saying before we started recording. The Trump world can cast aspersions and create a cloud of controversy, but at the end of the day, the people who write the history books will not really care about that. They will care about the facts on the ground and what happened.
Yeah, this committee, it may not lead to any high-profile prosecution, so it does feel like Watergate, we're going to see a lot of mid-level people, you know, the McCords, the G. Gordon Liddy's of the world, similar crowd that this had, they're going behind bars.
I mean, it's very similar where you saw mid-level people be prosecuted, but the chief executive, Richard Nixon, not be prosecuted, but he left public view because he was cast out by his own party. That is the difference here. You could still see mid-level prosecutions. You could still see the Justice Department go after people for trying to overturn the election. But will Republicans repudiate Trump, or even after, mm-hmm. Even in a world where he could be indicted or even is indicted, will they continue to embrace him? We know that a lot of his supporters probably would. I'm trying to imagine something that could supercharge his campaign, like being indicted by the Justice Department. But what will Republicans do?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And I want to go to Peter one more time on the political side of things. But Katie, I want to talk about, I thought it was fascinating last week that suddenly the Justice Department made sure the public knew about all of their actions regarding investigations on January 6th, subpoenas that went out, search warrants that were executed. I say this, is this just coincidental that all this action's happening right when January 6th committee members are kind of getting antsy about wondering what justice is doing? And McGarland's like, hey, just make all this public this week so people will get off our back.
Well, I don't think it's coincidental.
That's the Washington cynic in me. But anyway.
No. And also, keep in mind, those steps are not the Justice Department trying to make an investigation public. We've seen in every investigation, once you start raiding someone's house or subpoenaing them, the reporters always catch wind of that. So that's exactly when an investigation stops being under wraps, which is why you don't take those steps just before an election, by the way, because everybody knows that those steps are de facto public. But I think that the reason it's not a coincidence is not for maybe the Washington more cynical reason, but it's because the Justice Department understands that if their potential witnesses are about to give public testimony, you might want to work as quickly as possible in order to secure your own testimony, in order to secure your own evidence before people say publicly things that could be damning, incriminating, or could cause, folks who are under the scrutiny of the Justice Department to act. So the Justice Department understands that these public hearings do create somewhat of a shot clock for them in order to act before people, for example, would move to get rid of evidence or something.
And Katie, there's no avoiding a grand jury subpoena.
Exactly.
You're right. Pat Cipollone can hem and haul. He wants to a congressional committee. Not so with a grand jury, correct?
Correct.
Do we know if one's been impaneled on this yet and is only focused on this? Do we know if this is a special grand jury? Or is it just a regular grand jury that they use for any of these?
A grand jury is issuing subpoenas and has been on January 6th. And so do we know
if it's a special one or if it's just devoted to this or part of just...
What we know is that the grand jury has been impaneled, and I imagine that they've had at least one new grand jury because this investigation started on January 7th of 2021, but that the prosecution has divided now into three lanes. So you still have one woman, Michelle Zamarin, inside the U.S. Attorney's Office, and she's still doing the January 6th prosecutions, a.k.a. the people who broke in. You have another woman looking at the conspiracies amongst the far-right groups, and so that has led us to these seditious conspiracy cases. And then we have a man named Thomas Windham who is working on are there prosecutions to be had in the lead up to January 6th? So looking at
the elector business, all of that.
Exactly. Like Eastman, the fake elector scheme, Clark. Eastman, Jeff Clark, the lawyers around Trump.
So this is a guy named Windham. Where does he work?
Thomas Windham. So he
Tell
was,
me about him.
He was in a U.S. attorney's office, I believe, in Baltimore, and he has been detailed over to the U.S. attorney's office in D.C. You know, when think about the way this prosecution is looking, it feels a little bit like any kind of special team. I mean, Mueller has a lot
of issues. If there were a special counsel, and in this case, it's not, but
there's no special counsel in this case, but under the special counsel's office, you know, you had like Andrew Weissman looking at Manafort. You had Andrew Goldstein looking at obstruction. This is sort of similar in that you have one prosecutor looking at the people broke in, another prosecutor looking at, you know, conspiracy and the far right, and then another prosecutor who's looking at sort of like the White House Trump world.
Peter, we wrote a lead in First Read the other day about how sort of the fascinating but four paragraphs potentially that could be developing in a post midterm if, you know, boy, but for Trump meddling here, but for Roe v. Wade there, but for January 6th. He, you know, you see where I'm going here.
I do.
It is. Do the Trump folks realize how much of their political, their sort of political strength is on the ballot now? You know, if abortion holds the party back, if January 6th, you know, and the horrible decisions he's made in endorsements and chasing out people like Doug Ducey and Chris Sununu, like, you know. If Democrats end up with control of the Senate and the Republican pickup in the House is like, you know, 10, you could attribute it to one person directly and indirectly, Donald J. Trump. Are they aware of how much their sort of strength is on the ballot in November?
I think they're aware they're very much on the ballot, but I don't think you can attribute a grand strategy to what Trump is doing. I think Trump acts in instinctual ways. He acts reflexively. Right. He gets mad and he decides to tweet something or post something. And I think that's kind of what's happening here. Like, as I mentioned, the Republican National Committee, the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, Central Committees don't want to talk about Trump. They don't want to talk about January 6th. They want to talk about Biden. They want Biden to be on the ballot. They want Biden to be a referendum on Biden. They want to talk about inflation. They want to talk about gas prices. Trump, in a way, is not letting them, Chuck. I mean,
he's gotten in the way. That's my point. He's haunting the midterm. I feel like he's haunting the GOP in these midterms. I mean, both in individual races and also thematically.
I think that's right. But I think that's always been the case with him. I mean, he's not necessarily a party builder in that sense. He is the leader of a movement. The movement is the MAGA movement. It may or may not have something to do with the Republicans. If the Republicans can help him make money, raise money, get campaign contributions, he's happy to align with them. But really, it's about his aggrandizement. It's about him being the center of attention. It's about his interests. And I think that's what we're seeing play out. And it might be to the detriment of the Republican Party in the midterms, as you noted.
Peter, there's one important detail that means nothing for the prosecutions or indictments or any of this stuff, but I can't get over, and I know this isn't new, but to hear it again yesterday, Donald Trump Jr. panicked, was desperate to get his father to do something, and he went to Mark Meadows. I cannot get my arms around the president's oldest son couldn't go to his father about this.
You know, it's funny because I noticed the same thing and I scratched my head over that too. I mean, I'm fortunate enough that I have my father's cell phone. When I need to talk to him, I call him up and he answers on the first ring. Then again, he's not a president or former president, but you like to think that there is space in your life for your adult, for your children.
I've never missed a call from my kids.
Yeah, right. And, you know, there's a history to that. You know, about various presidents who would, you know, we know what happened with Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton when they were in the White House, how much space they carved out for Chelsea and how they discouraged the media from reporting, tried to protect Chelsea. And, you know, there was just a special place in their lives for their children as there were for the Obamas. So this was just peculiar that Donald Trump Jr., the president's eldest son, has to go through the same kind of bureaucratic hoops as, you know, other White House officials who might want to talk to the president.
Look, it paints a character portrait, right? Yes. It just does.
It does.
Katie, Peter, this was a great way of paneling. I think we had a legal, political 1-2 punch, so I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chuck.
You've been listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Elias Miller, Justice Gilpin Green, and Matt Rivera. Theme music composed by Spoke Media. Meet the Press Now is live every day at 4 p.m. Eastern on NBC News Now. You can catch it anywhere. YouTube, meetthepress.com, or just Google NBC News Now, and it pops up for you. It's also available on demand. And of course, the big show is available every Sunday, wherever you get your NBC station. Thanks for listening, and until we upload again.